I'm Rabia Yemin here with Liz Perley, author of Money, a Memoir, which I originally thought was, just on first glance at the cover, was going to be a humorous novel. The title made me chuckle, and as I got to about the third page, I realized, this isn't really that funny. So was writing the book cathartic?
I don't think it was cathartic as much as it was humiliating to really face my own money behavior and all the emotions I had around money and all the completely politically incorrect feelings that I had and expectations when it really came to me as a woman and money.
Why did you write the book?
I have been dedicated to women and writing about women for years and years and years. And indeed, when I was a book publisher, that was my specialty. And I realized that until women get honest about what their relationship is with money, they are never going to be independent and safe and secure the way they need to be.
Do you consider yourself a feminist?
Absolutely.
How do you define the word feminist?
I believe that a feminist is somebody who believes that she has the right to take care of herself and all the equal access and means to do that.
Did you start out as a feminist?
Yeah, I did. My mom died when I was very young. I was raised by my father. I was raised, you know, with that fiction that you can do anything you want to do, which of course is a total fiction. But you can do a lot of what you want to do if you're given the means and the opportunity to do it. And I took that very much to heart, and I went to a college where they were just admitting women, and I broke into a business where it was mostly male-dominated in the sales world, in publishing. And I never really let being a woman stop me, except I always had that other side of me that thought, well, one day, even though I had been making all the money all along and supporting myself, you know, one day someone's going to come in here and take care of me and make me financially secure, and I won't have to worry about my old age. And I, you know, equated care and cash, that if somebody really loved me, they would come pay my bills and do my taxes. I fell in love with somebody who promised to do just that. And the problem was, feminist that I am, I couldn't wait to get rid of the checkbook. I offloaded it, handed it to him, and said, you want to do this? Go nuts. I'll make the money. I just don't want to have to think about it. And some years later, I found myself on my best friend's sofa in San Francisco with a four-year-old, a box of toys, and $1,500 in cash. Because we had gotten divorced quite suddenly. He was living in Singapore, controlling all the money. And I found myself out of luck and shocked that I had allowed this to happen.
How long ago was that?
8 years.
That's not that long.
No. And, you know, it was my wake-up call, although I didn't realize it at the time. You know, that I say in the book, oh, this should have been my Scarlett O'Hara moment where I pulled the carrots from the earth and say, I'll never be hungry again. No, what it was a moment to go back to the sofa and start weeping for about 6 weeks. And then I realized I had to reconstruct my life. And the first thing I could not afford was this murky relationship with cash. I always said, oh, I'm a word person. You know, I don't like numbers. I don't like money. And that is just a luxury that I couldn't afford anymore.
One of the messages that I got from the book was that the secret or spoken wish that eventually you'll partner up with a man who will provide financial security cut across every economic, class, race, and educational boundary. Did you find that to be true?
Absolutely. I went across the country. I interviewed more than 200 women, mostly. This is such a weird cultural phenomenon. You know, I call it drinking the cultural Kool-Aid because women, in spite of the fact that we all expect to provide for ourselves at some point in our lives, we still have this feeling that there's something that's going to rescue us. Now, Prince Solvency doesn't need to be a man. It can be a job, the lotto ticket, the dead rich uncle. But there is this fantasy thinking about money in the long term, and it's very emotionally based. Because this is not a financial situation but an emotional condition, that's why it cuts across every class and every group of people that I've talked to, regardless of region or background.
Where do you think the root of that fear comes from?
I think it comes from centuries of powerlessness as women. one of the strange things that has happened is, you know, at warp speed in three generations, women have gone from being the money in some cases, you know, here, I my dowry and here I am, gone from being valued for our looks or our health or our ability to reproduce or our ability to take care of aging parents. We've gone from that currency to a salaried currency. Some of us, you know, some people still work in the home and experience more of the sort of lack of recognition of the value of the work they do by society, as we still are arguing. But I think we've got these two tracks that live in women. One is the life of our fathers, and the other is the life of our mothers. And each one of those tracks that we are charged with of living has a value system sitting inside of it. And the conflict between these two value systems, the one that still values men by how much money they make and how they can provide, and the one that still values women by our womanly arts, for lack of a better way of putting it, these fight within us and they create tremendous anxiety. Add a credit card to that and see what happens. What do we do when we get anxious? We eat or we shop. Or, in my case, I do both. Most women I interviewed will admit not to being a big shopper. We tend to buy things for other people. This is one of the ways we disguise what we do to ourselves, because we don't want to admit these things about ourselves. When I started writing the book, the average debt was $8,000 a month on a credit card in this country, and now a year later it was $9,000. And women are going bankrupt, and women aren't putting money away for their retirement. And women aren't taking care of themselves because of this magical thinking. And it has huge repercussions for us in the long run.
In your book, you actually quoted a statistic that, partially due to the fact that women live longer than men, but 87% of the impoverished elderly are women.
Yeah. And, you know, those statistics never scared me into putting money into a 401k or into my IRA, because I always had something that was more pressing. And indeed, I'm neurotic enough that I have always sort of managed to sock away a little bit. So I'm not as in bad shape as some of my friends, but I look around, you know, as we all cross the 50-yard line, it's getting, the horizon's coming up fast here. And I really worry about what's going to happen to my friends when they realize, my cousin's the perfect example. You know, she's saved nothing. She's 53 years old. She has no husband. What's going to happen to her?
So you do see this as a feminist issue?
At its core. And one of the things that really got my attention, you know, I have a 12-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl. And I was interviewing a woman named Jolene Godfrey, who's quite brilliant. She wrote a book called Raising Financially Fit Kids. And she said, you know, when a boy mows a lawn, we tell him he's being very enterprising. And when a girl babysits, we tell her she's good with kids. That's still true today. And this translates into things like not negotiating for your first salary. And there's new research out from Carnegie Mellon that shows that men are four times as likely to negotiate that first salary as women. And the price women pay by the time they're 60, they leave more than $500,000 unearned because of that failure to negotiate the first salary. Men compare it to going to a good ball game, you know, a good salary negotiation. And women compare it to going to the dentist. So there are gender differences around our approach and the way we identify as women to money. We don't mind making it, but we don't want to be seen as material human beings. We're full of these paradoxes, and the emotional result of those paradoxes are keeping us from taking care of ourselves. So it's absolutely a feminist issue.
And that sounds like the same dynamic that says when a man asks for what he wants at work, he's assertive and aggressive and enterprising, and a woman is
pushy, money-grabbing. We have such a great vocabulary for all of that. And as a matter of fact, I've talked to large groups of women, and I say, you know, who here identifies themselves as a material human being? Not one hand goes up. You know, we lie about what we buy all the time. Shave a couple of bucks off the price of a lipstick. Oh, I got it on sale. You know, I've amazed my friends with reports of things on sale that never, ever were. And I lied to my husband the other day. I had to buy a winter coat because I'm going back east. And I said, oh, it was $300. Well, it was $350. He doesn't care. But I couldn't face my own materialism. I couldn't face the fact that I had spent $350 on a coat.
And you wrote the book.
And I wrote the book.
So what would you say to a woman who tells you they don't want to spend their time at work, and yet they still don't want to be financially dependent on a man. In other words, work isn't working for them.
You know, if we're all smart people, and if the imbalance between work and the need to earn a living and life and the need to take care of the ones we love, if that was just a matter of the clock, we would have solved this long ago. There is a lack of ability in this country and many countries in the Western civilization to value the non-money-making parts of life. Let's just put it that way, the things for which we don't get a paycheck. And what we're dealing with is not a war of the clock. It's not a war of wills. It's not even the mommy, stay-at-home mommy versus working mommy debate, which drives me completely out of my mind. I think that's such a, you know, that's a brush fire issue as opposed to the real burning ember, which is that we have two different value systems, and they have to be valued in a way on par with each other in a way that allows us to build structures in our lives that work. When I came back to San Francisco after Singapore and I was divorced, I went to find a job because I needed money. But I went with my principles. So I get a job. I tell them I will take a pay cut from what they offer if they will let me pick up my kid 2 days a week and I'll work at home. They didn't like it, but they said, well, we'll try it. And it so upset the apple cart there. For 4 years, I was resented by my coworkers and by my employers for this. And I stuck to it because I felt it was, A, important for my son, but also on principle. But, boy, I tell you, I paid for it 3 times over in upsetting the apple cart because people don't like it when you do something like that.
So it sounds like that problem is real deeply rooted in our culture and not something that one person can fix. So if the problem is so systemic, what's the solution?
Well, the solution is living by your principles, because one of the things that I have noticed, when a woman speaks the truth, other women listen. And when a woman does something that is in her best interest, other women support them. And it gives people courage. But the only way I feel comfortable facing feelings is if someone else is out there talking about the same thing with me. So I really hoped to start a conversation on this whole issue. And honest, I say in the book, I stand up, I'll be the first fool. This is what I do. I don't balance my checkbook. I don't open my Visa bills. You know, I am a financial disaster. I have a guy who manages my 401k who sends me notes quarterly. Are you dead? You know, he's trying to figure out why I'm so completely uninterested in my own well-being. So I figured if I went out and talked to women about this and said, it's okay to talk about this. You don't have to club someone over the head with how much money you make or what your net worth is, but you do have to talk about your feelings and your avoidances and your denial when it comes to money. And it sparked this incredible conversation. And that's the beginning of change.
I can definitely say about your book that I laughed and I cried for all the wrong reasons.
Oh, well, you know, the one thing I want, and I do put a lot of humor in the book, and I do it because I want there to be forgiveness. I mean, too much in this culture, women end up shouldering individual blame for what's a cultural problem. And I want women to feel forgiven and that they're not alone. You know, we all do this stuff. We run away from it. And we're encouraged to do it because it fits the sort of Disney fantasy of what the American dream is.
Yeah, or the American nightmare. What do you want women to take away from this book?
The fact that often we have an emotional relationship with money, that it affects our behavior with our parents, our loved ones, our children, our employers. It's everywhere. And we end up doing weird things, twisting into pretzels, behaving in ways that aren't in our best interest, to stay attached to the source of security if we can find it. I want women to be aware of the ways in which money silently directs their actions, because there's nothing wrong with having money direct your actions. Just don't pretend that it doesn't. We're not having the same conversation about money. A man's in there having a conversation about cash. A woman's having a conversation about, do you love me? Do you recognize me? We just don't think society will let us ask and still love us.
I'm Rabia Yemen. I'm talking with Liz Perley, author of Money, a Memoir. How have men responded to your book and the ideas in it?
I looked at Amazon the other day, and there was a very short review from a man saying, I think all men should read this book because they'll understand the women in their lives better.
In your book, you mentioned that younger women told you they didn't expect to depend on men economically. Do you believe that?
Absolutely not. I think they're perpetuating the same myth, just with a slightly different, twist than the same myth we had. You know, this culture still sets girls up to play into the rescue fantasy. When's the last Disney movie we all saw? I mean, it's really quite stunning to me. I was looking at the TV this morning, and they had a commercial, and there was a woman who was clearly supposed to be the babysitter of a little girl, and the little girl, they're making Valentine's, and she says, Susie, or whatever the babysitter's name is, I think Brian likes you. And Susie pulls out of her a shirt, a 3-diamond-tiered necklace, and says, oh, I think he does, too. Look, he showed me. And I looked at this ad, and I thought, America, wake up. This is a babysitter whose boyfriend supposedly gave her 3 diamonds for Valentine's Day to show her he loves her, and this is what she's teaching a 6-year-old girl. This is not helping.
Do you think that younger women, after they get involved in life partnerships, will revert to the security model?
I think that they have more models to choose from, and I think younger women today do grow up knowing they have to work. Whereas it was still somewhat elective in my generation, somewhat. Now everybody's got to work. This whole business of, in 1958, when credit cards started, we didn't know that kids would be coming out of college today with $17,000 in average tuition bills, never mind the $15,000 in credit card debt that these kids have racked up. Because you go to college and you get 6-7 credit cards. You charge up 6 or 7 up to the maximum of $1,000 or whatever you get on the cards. And look at the bills you've got. These kids have no income. This is criminal as far as I'm concerned. So young girls come out of college today knowing they have to work. They just know because they're already in the hole. But there's also this sort of funny money thing that they've got because they've had this magic money in credit cards. And I don't think they really realize what the consequences of all that behavior is until it's too late.
Do you see the same dynamics in same gender relationships with money?
Boy, I've been asked this question. Interestingly enough, I did a little research on this because I was curious to know how much of it was biological, honestly, and how much of it was sociological. And the answer is some of each. In every relationship, regardless of gender, one person takes the hoarder mentality and one takes the spender. And the beautiful thing about this behavior is it's completely portable. I'm the hoarder in my new relationship, and I was the spender in my old relationship. Now, this is gender free. There are, however, similarities that are gender based, such as the reluctance to negotiate a salary. Now, these are generalizations, obviously, but the fact that, as this one physician at University of California, San Francisco was saying, she's a female brain specialist. She said women for 3 million years have been hardwired to create community and men to create hierarchy. So men are much more comfortable with the social order that money is. Money creates an instant hierarchy. Women have other ways of creating pecking orders, but it's not as hierarchical. And the first impulse, you put a group of women in a room together, what are we going to do? We're going to find something in common, not what separates us. That is not societal. That's just gender behavior.
What happens when your values change? Could you speak to that?
What happens if I put time with my family at the center of my life? What changes? And it's like the song, they all roll over, one fell out. Some of the money fell out, but I still had made enough money to be able to do what I needed to do. Maybe I couldn't take that trip to Europe or something, but I knew what the trade-offs were, and it works.
Are you suggesting that some women may intentionally choose a more austere lifestyle in exchange for control over her time and making a decision to earn less and have less expendable income, which is a luxury for many people? but that making that choice doesn't make you a bad person or flaky or lazy. It simply is a trade-off, and that should not carry an emotional charge necessarily.
Well, when you know, I'm careful of the word should or shouldn't carry an emotional charge. All of it carries emotional charge. You know, I call that chapter where I really talk about facing these trade-offs ego side. Because, you know, you just got to kill the ego that says we're primed to do more and want more, and we're primed to chase success and all of these things. And to, it's very hard to reverse something like that.
What about identity with material possessions? That's what I was hearing, that you are not your drapes, or the neighbor or the neighborhood does not make them woman.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, what am I? Talk about your basic uphill battles. With the marketing machinery and the branding, I mean, America's gone a little goofy on this subject. Our homes are twice the size they were 20 years ago. Our bathrooms have turned into spas. Suddenly, four burners on a stove should be six. You know, I myself lust after a double oven. We get into this. First of all, it's our home. It's not ourselves. We're not spending on ourselves. But of course we are. You know, it is another form of expression. And we really do look to our left and rights, and this is one of the way that women sort of compare themselves to other women, and by what kind of home and whatever. And it's buyer beware on this one. And it's hard to swim upstream against this kind of cultural current, because it's a torrent.
So are you saying that materialism is the middle class crack?
I didn't say that, but it's a nice way of putting it. You know, we are material beings, and I think if we try and deny that, that's the first step on the steep path to sheer ruin. We're material human beings. We like our goodies, and it's okay to like our goodies. It's just a question of getting it all sort of in perspective and knowing what emotion is fueling them. Is it because you feel less than that you need to have a six-burner stove, or because you cook a lot? Those are very different, you know, motivations towards having something. I mean, one of the things I don't want to be here is one of these don't buy people simple, you know, I remember that. Remember the Simple is Beautiful books where you're supposed to give up everything and live with nothing? I'm not that person. But I'm also not Imelda Marcos. I don't have 200 pairs of shoes. I think that the question becomes, you know, what do you want and what do you need, and recognizing the difference between the two. And if you can afford what you want on a given day, that's great. But you got to get what you need. And you can't disguise your wants as needs.
What would you say to women who are, for whatever reason, have and probably will remain on an economic precipice? They are, you know, women that are working at Walmart, the women that are working two or three jobs to support their families, where there may or may not be another partner contributing economically. These ideas of saying, well, get in touch with your emotions about money might seem ludicrous or even insensitive to them, where they're feeling very trapped by their low-paying jobs and are just scraping by.
You bet. And as a matter of fact, at one point I called my literary agent and said, I'm giving back the money. How, you know, who the hell am I to write a book like this when there are people out there who are making minimum wage or less, when, you know, their jobs are being given away and being replaced by burger flipping jobs. And I say this very clearly right up front in the beginning of the book, you know, the tyranny of choice is a pale shadow against the tyranny of need. And there are people in this country, the working poor, the non-working poor, who, for whom this book is an insult, in a sense, because it represents an array of choices of the club of disposable income. And I almost stopped writing about it because I felt so guilty that I was writing about what's basically a middle-class problem. And I sat with it for a while and realized I should keep writing the book, because we are a middle-class country, and change has to come from somewhere. It's hideous that we have the working poor in a country as rich as this is. It's a crime, and I'm not going to solve it, and this book isn't going to solve it, and this book is not for them. It isn't. And I had to get over the fact that it doesn't solve that problem still doesn't make it legitimate for those who are running into this situation.
You know, what I heard you saying over and over again in the book was, get real.
Yeah.
Get real about money. Well, I really want to thank you for being with us today, Liz Perley, author of Money, a Memoir. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that was interviewer Rabia Yemin and her guest, Liz Perley, author of Money, a Memoir, Women, Emotions, and Cash. Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is a Tuesday radio zine coming up at 10:30 at Stage and Studio. D. May Roberts looks at the experiences and contributions of Southeast Asian refugees who came to Portland after the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam in 1975. And it's Democracy Now! At 11. A couple of the topics, a look at the militarization of the border with Mexico, and a feature on CorpWatch's new report, Hurricane Halliburton, Conflict, Climate Change, and Catastrophe. Coming up right now, we have Bruce Silverman with his guest, Elizabeth Grossman.